Pelosi is pushing aside the process complaints by Republicans. All we're left with is the substance, are the facts, and the facts are damning. So I think that we will have a real trial in the Senate if indeed articles of impeachment get sent to us.
This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Tuesday, October 29th. Today, we'll dig into yet another piece of explosive testimony from yet another person you probably never heard of until today. And this witness was actually on the July 25th phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's President Zelensky. We'll dig into what Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman is telling the House, maybe at this very moment. Also, we'll talk to Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, who you just heard there in that clip, a leading Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, about the trial that's becoming more and more likely in the Senate. And we'll also discuss the other big impeachment headline, Speaker Pelosi announcing that the first vote to get congresspeople on the record supporting or opposing this inquiry will take place on Thursday. So it's one dramatic turn after another just in the last 24 hours. So here we go. With me for this are Associated Press White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire and New York Times Magazine correspondent, Yale Law School fellow, and Slate political GabFest co-host Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for coming on today.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Jonathan, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, immigrant from Ukraine as a child, wounded in the Iraq War and awarded a Purple Heart, a foreign affairs officer specializing in Ukraine and Russia since 2008, appointed just last year by the Trump administration to serve at the National Security Council. Why was he on the phone call between the two presidents?
He was on the call because he's a member of the National Security Council. He's the top Ukraine expert there. He is the first White House official now to offer testimony. In the statement, his opening statement, which the media got a preview of last night, he says that twice he registered concerns about the president's phone call with the Ukrainian leader. He said that out of a sense of duty, twice, he went to his superiors and said he was disturbed by what he heard, that he felt that it was inappropriate, that he registered the idea of this quid pro quo. He thought there was an idea of a threat being carried out by the president of the United States. And what we have seen here is in the last barely 12 hours, the conservative media already sort of, and other Republicans who support the president, hearing to talking points that are sort of almost hard to fathom for someone who served his country, suggests playing up his Ukrainian heritage, suggesting that because he emigrated from a country that used to be part of the Soviet bloc, that perhaps he's conflicted here, even questioning his sense of patriotism.
So let's back off and take those big things that you just said one by one and dive into each a little bit. And Emily, Colonel Vindman's opening remarks display as 6 pages long. They've been published. Let me read a few quotes, some of the things that Jonathan referred to there, but let me drill a little deeper on these and get your comments. He says, "I am not the whistleblower who brought this issue to the CIA and the committee's attention. I did convey certain concerns internally to national security officials in accordance with my obligation to operate within the chain of command. I have never had direct contact or communications with the president." Those are all quotes. Then he speaks about that infamous July 10th meeting that he was at between various U.S. and Ukrainian officials, including his boss, Security Advisor Fiona Hill, and her boss, National Security Advisor John Bolton, plus two other ambassadors involved with Trump in demanding investigations by Ukraine, Kurt Volker and Gordon Sondland, all these names who've been in the news. July 10th meeting. Colonel Vindman writes, "The meeting proceeded well until the Ukrainians broached the subject of a meeting between the two presidents. Ambassador Sondland started to speak about Ukraine delivering specific investigations in order to secure the meeting with the president, at which time Ambassador Bolton cut the meeting short. Following this meeting, there was a scheduled debriefing during which Ambassador Sondland emphasized the importance that Ukraine deliver the investigations into the 2016 elections, the Bidens, and Burisma." That's the company Hunter Biden was on the board of. Vindman continues, "I stated to Ambassador Sondland that his statements were inappropriate, that the request to investigate Biden and his son had nothing to do with national security, and that such investigations were not something the NSC was going to get involved in or push. Dr. Hill then entered the room and asserted to Ambassador Sondland that his statements were inappropriate. Following the debriefing meeting, I reported my concerns to the National Security Council's lead counsel. Dr. Hill also reported the incident to the NSC's lead counsel, unquote, from Vindman's opening statement. So, woo. Let's stop there for the moment. Emily, as the legal eagle here right now, how big is that July 10th meeting? And the fact that both he and his boss, Fiona Hill, reported it to the National Security Council's lead attorney.
Right. I mean, I think what you see here are officials who are working the kind of regular channels of American policy and diplomacy getting alarmed about what seemed irregular to them, this kind of quid pro quo. And that seemed wrong to the folks who were reporting it to their superiors and especially to the legal counsel. That demonstrates they were concerned about a legal problem with this idea of an exchange.
Jonathan, we see from that exchange at that July 10th meeting, a clear divide between two groups of Trump appointees. And this is not new, but it's being confirmed yet again. Those who are pressuring Ukraine for these investigations of Democrats and those who are appalled and think it's highly inappropriate.
That's exactly right. We've seen here the half of the Trump's administration, those involved in this, and those include those outside of the administration, that means Rudy Giuliani, who of course are, from day one, have seen Ukraine that it was an answer to the Russia investigation, suggesting that this here is an alternative explanation as to what happened in 2016, that the president could not have colluded with Russia because, look, there was nefarious doings, they're claimed, not backed up by fact, between the Democrats and Ukraine, including what is quite frankly the debunked theory that the DNC server was somehow being held in Ukraine. And they were using this also to attempt to dig up dirt against Joe Biden, who at the time they believed was the president's number one threat in the 2020 election. And then there are those who want to conduct foreign policy like foreign policy has always been conducted, who see Ukraine as a strategic ally, a nation that needs, you know, that is inching towards Europe, is needs American support to hold off Russia. And I think that the testimony a week or so back from Ambassador Taylor remains the most damning, the most haunting, because he explained this in sort of very human terms. He described that scene standing in Ukraine, looking over the bridge at these Russian-backed forces. And he thought to himself and described in his testimony the idea that Ukrainians would lose their lives if this military aid did not come through. And that just sort of raises the stakes on this entire matter, where it's more than just politics. It's about people and their livelihoods and their very survival.
All right, let me go on to the Trump-Zelensky phone call on July 25th. As described in this opening statement today by Colonel Vindland, he writes, on July 25th, 2019, the call occurred. I listened in on the call in the Situation Room with colleagues from the National Security Council and the Office of the Vice President. As the transcript is in the public record, we are all aware of what was said. I was concerned by the call. I did not think it was proper to demand that a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen, and I was worried about the implications for the U.S. government's support of Ukraine. I realized that if Ukraine pursued an investigation into the Bidens and Burisma, it would likely be interpreted as a partisan play, which would undoubtedly result in Ukraine losing the bipartisan support that it has thus far maintained. This would all undermine U.S. national security. Following the call, I again reported my concerns to the NSC's lead counsel. So, Emily, I again turn to you and ask if you know, if anybody knows, who is this lead counsel person? And after receiving multiple complaints about inappropriate behavior by the president from his own appointees, multiple ones, and now inappropriate, you know, behavior by the president himself, in addition to that of his appointees after the phone call that the president had, what has this counsel done about it, if anything is known?
Right. I don't think we know what the counsel did about it. What you're hearing here, whenever you have people turning to the lawyers, and the lawyer here is John Eisenberg, who was the top lawyer at the National Security Council, it's a red flag. It doesn't necessarily mean something illegal happened, but it means the people who are working on this issue and presumably know the boundaries of how this diplomacy is supposed to work are concerned. And I think the person who could tell us the most about what results this led to in the National Security Council is either Mr. Eisenberg, this lawyer, or John Bolton, who was the National Security Advisor at the time, has since left. His departure from the Trump administration, of course, comes right before the whistleblower complaint breaks into the news, and we are seeing people who worked for Bolton either testify or be called to testify. And so his role in this and what he says went down, I think, is increasingly a big question that a lot of us are asking.
Now, there's so much corroboration at this point of the evidence for the Trump people demanding or extorting or bribing or whatever you want to call it, the president of Ukraine to launch these investigations. And the Wall Street Journal today has yet another one. Even Trump's ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, who is one of the central people in on the whole pressure campaign, one of the so-called three amigos. The Journal quotes Sondland's lawyer saying that even Sondland testified to the House committees last week that he believed the demand for investigations in exchange for a White House meeting was a quid pro quo. So I think we're heading into a new phase. Tell me if you agree, Emily, where it all may come down to one question. Was the president's improper behavior, that everyone's going to agree was improper, or almost everyone, bad enough to warrant removal from office? Is that the almost single focal point that we're heading toward now, in your opinion?
That is a really important focal point. And I think it makes sense to focus on whether this is a serious enough offense, right? Like, in the world, we have crimes and misdemeanors, felonies and misdemeanors, I should say. And while it is true that Congress can impeach for high crimes or misdemeanors, you can also decide that the president did something wrong, but it doesn't rise to the level of removal from office. One of the important distinctions here that I think you're going to see increasing attention to, and we've already been looking at, is whether the quid pro quo was for something relatively small, like meeting with the Ukrainian president, or whether it was for releasing the military aid that Congress had authorized and Trump was withholding. That's a much more serious kind of quid pro quo. And William Taylor is the main person who I think has testified to that level of interference at this point, although there are other people who seem to be waiting in the wings.
I think the political argument is going to be about the quid pro quo. Is, I think we're all going, the argument, both sides are going to agree that it happened. The question is whether people believe it is wrong, or that is normal U.S. business, to be transactional, to offer a deal, to say to an ally, well, if you do this, if you do X, we'll do Y. And I think that is going to be how the Republicans will eventually have to coalesce and fight this matter, because the facts seem to be that this was indeed offered, this quid pro quo. And it's going to be simply like, well, yes, this happened, but other presidents have done it. This president has done it other times. And will that rise? Can you convince the American public that a deal like this, when you're, quote, trying to, quote, root out corruption, is worthy of removing a president? Is this a serious enough event to take a president from office?
And, Emily, Republicans have been calling the inquiry illegitimate because Speaker Pelosi has not held a vote of the full House to support it, even though such a vote is not required by law, not required by House rules. But now the Speaker has called a vote for this Thursday. What will they be voting on precisely, and why now?
They're going to vote on some of the rules for holding this impeachment inquiry. This is a vote that the White House counsel has claimed is necessary. That's not true. The House can set its own rules. The law on that is quite clear. But I think Pelosi thinks that the politics are stronger in favor of impeachment, and it's a good idea to get her members on the record and to get Republicans, presumably, against proceeding with impeachment, and to set some rules so that the public can see that this is happening in a more transparent fashion.
And Jonathan, politically, what position will that put Republicans in, do you think, House Republicans, if they try to deny even an inquiry into the president's behavior that has been so widely corroborated and vote against this resolution on Thursday? What position does that put them in?
A difficult one. We saw the White House response last night has already shifted. Now that Pelosi has suggested that she will have this vote, they're saying, well, you know, everything you've done prior to this vote is invalid and shouldn't be considered seriously. I think that Republicans, though, are going to have no choice but to go along with this. I mean, they will. These hearings will become public. So will there be moments where they can grandstand? Yes. But with House Intel now being the lead committee on this, some of the president's top defenders, the Jim Jordans, the Mark Meadows of the world, they're not going to be there. So that will be something that will be a little more difficult. Yes, they will flood the airwaves on Fox News, I am sure, and other places. But this is a president a White House that from day one has never been able to sort of get out ahead of the story. From their first step, the idea of releasing the transcript, which I think the president really pushed for, thinking it would exonerate him, of course, only fueled the fires of impeachment and by most counts, made the matter much worse. And they have, to this day, there's still no active war room beyond the president's Twitter account. They're losing the politics of this, and doing so, they're still seemingly caught by surprise of how fast this is. And the Democrats, to their credit, if we're playing umpire here and calling balls and strikes on this matter, you know, to be able to have nearly on a daily basis another witness providing testimony corroborating this has just built an extraordinary amount of momentum towards impeachment.
Can I ask one other question, a little bit off the topic, at least it's off the topic of Ukraine. But Emily, Trump's former chief of staff, General John Kelly, has said some critical things about the president. And the White House response to John Kelly yesterday from White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham was this quote. She said, "I worked with John Kelly, and he was totally unequipped to handle the genius of our great president." She actually said that. And my question for you, and then we're out of time, is that impeachable too? And I'm only half kidding, because only dictators like Kim Jong-un have their staffs talk about them like that. Maybe no leader of a democracy ever has before in any country.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable to hear that kind of talk. I don't think it's impeachable, just to state the obvious. I do think that we should pause for a moment to consider how remarkable it is that this series of witnesses is showing up. They've been subpoenaed by Congress, but they are choosing to obey that subpoena over a direct order from the president and the White House counsel. They're not caught up in the same problems of executive privilege, you know, the idea of maintaining the confidentiality of the president's communications, because, as Vindman said, like, he doesn't talk to the president directly. But they are still risking, presumably, their jobs, their pensions. They're choosing to tell the story. It's a really interesting kind of quiet or tacit partnership between Congress and these longtime government career professionals in these agencies, the people who work from administration to administration. So they don't have political ties. They are really loyal to the country and their jobs and to their notions of how you do diplomacy correctly.
Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times, co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest podcast, and Jonathan Lemire, AP White House correspondent. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
With us now, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, much in the news as a prominent Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who, among other things, visited Ukraine in September and met with President Zelensky there just as the Trump-Ukraine scandal was starting to break. Hi, Senator. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Ukraine first. You went there in September and spoke to President Zelensky. Did you already know about the whistleblower complaint or Trump and Giuliani pressure to investigate 2016 and the Bidens? And had the military aid been released yet?
We all knew about Giuliani's pressure campaign. It was public knowledge as far back as the spring. I wrote a letter to the Foreign Relations Committee Chairman, Senator Jim Risch, back in May asking for hearings because it just seemed absolutely preposterous to me that we were allowing one of the president's political representatives to pretend that he was making foreign policy. That's part of the reason I went to Ukraine. I agreed to join Senator Johnson on a trip there in early September because I had heard directly from my friends in Ukraine and those who knew Ukraine well that President Zelensky was very concerned about the pressure he was getting from Giuliani and others. He didn't understand whether they were direct communications from the president, whether it was actual U.S. foreign policy or whether this was a back channel he should ignore. And I raised it, as you mentioned, directly with President Zelensky while I was there. At that point, we did not know about the whistleblower. We did know that the aid had been withheld, but we did not know that there was this quid pro quo relationship between the aid and the demands for Zelensky to investigate the Bidens. But, you know, this idea that some people are trying to suggest that, you know, nobody knew about this until the whistleblower's complaint is ridiculous. Rudy Giuliani was bragging about going to Ukraine and representing himself as the president's emissary as far back as the spring.
So if you gave advice to President Zelensky on how to handle the Rudy Giuliani shadow foreign policy, what did you advise him?
Well, my advice was simple. You know, stay out of U.S. elections. It's not good for Ukraine to get dragged into American politics. My recommendation was for his communications with the U.S. government to run through the State Department. Now, at the time, I didn't understand that the State Department had, in fact, been co-opted into this political pressure campaign. I didn't know that that Kurt Volker and Gordon Sondland and others were trying to get Zelensky to do the president's political bidding, but I just knew that the one thing he shouldn't be doing is, having a direct relationship with folks who represented the president's political operation. There are plenty of people who work for the U.S. government that he could talk to.
You know that today's witness in the impeachment hearings, Colonel Vindman, a National Security Council staffer under John Bolton, who was actually on the July 25th phone call, is getting smeared already because he reportedly gave advice to Ukrainian officials on how to deal with Rudy Giuliani's shadow foreign policy, the same thing that you just described that you did. So do you need to defend maybe the two of you that and say it's appropriate for a U.S. official to counsel a foreign government on how to deal with someone representing our president?
But he's not representing the president of the United States in an official capacity. Listen, it's just amazing to me that that those of us who are telling a foreign leader to not interfere in a U.S. election are somehow at fault. I mean, the fact of the matter is that you can't allow for a foreign government to try to influence an American election. And, I absolutely stand by the advice that I gave Zelensky to stay out of U.S. politics. And I'm glad there are others in the White House that were trying to chill this massive corruption campaign. I mean, and if this gets normalized, the idea that the president can run a shadow foreign policy whereby he sends his political fixers all around the world to try to get governments to interfere in U.S. elections, then that's the end of democracy. And so I'm never going to stop trying to make sure that there is a separation between the president's financial agenda and his political agenda and American foreign policy.
Senator, the quid pro quo has been so corroborated now by so many Trump appointees, plus the phone call transcript notes from the White House itself. Do you think your Republican colleagues in the Senate are going to hold a serious trial if the House impeaches the president?
I think it'll be hard for them to try to short circuit a fair, serious trial in the Senate. I think it is absolutely clear what happened here. The president directed the people who work for him, both on his campaign and in the State Department, to trade away access to the White House and congressionally authorized and appropriated aid for political help. That's not allowed in a democracy. And I think that as Speaker Pelosi is sort of pushing aside the process complaints by Republicans, which were nonsense to begin with, all we're left with is the substance, are the facts, and the facts are damning. So I think that we will have a real trial in the Senate if indeed articles of impeachment get sent to us.
The question seems to me likely to come down to a judgment call. That is, the president did these things. It's been proven. But is this bad enough to remove a president from office? Do you think that's where this is all headed?
Well, we'll see. I mean, Republicans thus far have not been yet willing to concede the facts. Many of them today are saying that because they're jurors, they can't comment. Others have been focused very, you know, much on the process instead of the actual substance. You know, I hope that we get to a point at which we all agree that this quid pro quo happened, that this pressure campaign against Zelensky happened, because everyone is testifying to that. These people worked for Donald Trump. They were in the room in these meetings, and they all attest to the fact that the president was trying to trade away the credibility of the United States to get interference in U.S. politics. And hopefully we do get to the point where we all stipulate to those facts, and then it's just a question of whether that is conduct worthy of removal from office.
You would be a juror, too, if a trial takes place in the Senate. Do you already have an answer to that question for yourself, if it's worthy of removal from office?
I think this conduct is likely worthy of removal. I obviously have to wait to see the exact articles of impeachment that get sent over before I make a determination. But I've come to the conclusion that the precedent we would set by allowing a president of the United States to, you know, break this covenant he makes with the U.S. people not to use the massive power of his office for his own personal gain, I think the precedent that we would set would be really damaging for the nation.
Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, thanks so much. Keep coming on.
Thanks, Brent.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Questions, thoughts, feelings, ideas, and anything else you want to share with us about what you're watching for in the impeachment inquiry. Give us a call and leave us a voicemail, and you might get to hear your voice on the podcast. The number is 844-745-TALK. Just leave us a message. Again, it's 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon at WNYC.org.